And I'm thrilled to be with you today. These are really, really important conversations. We have a chance to have a conversation about what's going on in ag trade around the world. And I just got back from China Sunday night. Pretty extraordinary meeting. Nick, you know, I was part of the crew in the last farm bill that got the Undersecretary for Trade created in the last farm bill, and it was by happenstance that we happened to get all that done, but we did. And when we were sitting down with industry to map out how we would do this, where, you know, the Undersecretary would pull people from APHIS and the Food Safety Inspection Service and Foreign Ag Service, and guys from USTR would come along, and we did that in China last week, folks. We had 25 people on our end of the table. They had 25 people on their end of the table. And talking to Dick Crowder and Sharon and all the old guard, that was the first time we've done anything like that maybe since 2007. And what I want to tell you, Nick, and this is letting everybody else listen to the conversations we have in D.C., is Nick, you know how we drew that up on the chalkboard? That's exactly how it went, and it worked. And it worked. We had quite a conversation. And, of course, the challenge with China is that these things are difficult. These things are incremental. You think you agree upon something, then you get on an airplane and suddenly it just kind of vanishes into thin air. But we caught them at a good time in China, I think, because they were undergoing a major reorganization of their ag ministry over there. Undersecretary McKinney, Ted McKinney, and I's counterparts were kind of new in their jobs, but pretty people that we knew. And we would ask questions and really get on them about things, and they would look at their, you know, career folks and really get after them. And it was a pretty robust discussion. So we'll see how that goes. We did get a few things done, but we've got a long way to go with China. You know, the challenge that we face in pork with China today, and I don't want to go into a lot, you know, I could sit here and talk numbers all day long, but my understanding is, you know, China, we all know the size of that hog industry in the world, but in the last year, their pork price has come down about 50%. Since the first of the year, I'm told it's come down about 30%. So, you know, China is a command and control economy. They're, you know, the forces of supply and demand are just not something that really reverberate with them very well. And so when that happens, they're looking to shut off valves in terms of meat imports and grain imports and trying to turn these things around. I'm confident that over the longer period of time, China's going to need us in agriculture. And regardless of what the short-term situations are, and we're going to talk about those for a little bit, we had an opportunity to engage with Secretary Ross over there last week. And for U.S. agriculture's part and USDA and USTR's part in agriculture, we took that opportunity. And every time we're going to get that chance to do that, we're going to do that and continue to do that because of the importance of how that is. Challenge for us, as we see it right now, though, particularly in pork, is everybody else in the world is growing like we are. You know, our pork production is up, what, Nick, 5% on the year. The production in Europe is up 2%. And in Europe, you know, I'm not sure that their domestic consumption is going to keep up with that. The Europeans have deals with Japan. Everybody's got deals going on all over the world right now. We've got to keep up with that and have an ability to export our product. And on the pork side of the equation, we're exporting somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% of our production today. For my part, I keep explaining to the folks that I work for in our shop, you know, the goal is to take that to 30 and then maybe someday take it to 35. And as you do that, that means that if you have hiccups and problems, all of a sudden, the size of that production is not going to be able to be handled in the domestic marketplace. So it makes it our ability to resolve issues in the international marketplace when you have that much of your production leaving the country is there a word beyond critical, Nick, that we could use here? It's unbelievably important that we have an ability to do this. And so, you know, we on the meat side of the equation, for my part in my job right now, I see, you know, meat as the real opportunity longer term for demand growth in the world and for the U.S. ability to provide that meat. I think when you sit down and talk to China, they will talk to you about, you know, resource constraints, water, land, grain availability. And as the Kansas farm boy sitting across the table, I just kind of smile and think to myself, you know, we got a lot of that. We can do a lot in terms of growing more beef, pork, and poultry in the United States now and in the future. And it's amazing to me, as an old commodity analyst, you know, our beef production is up 5%, our pork production is up 5%, and regardless of all the wrinkles that we have going on, we're able to hold pretty steady on price. That's amazing. Let's be clear. When you're adding that much production year on year and you're able to move it and make it all work, that tells you two things. Number one, the U.S. economy is strong. There is absolutely no question about that. And number two, the world economy is strong and our ability to export these things is good and getting better. We're constantly working on these issues to try to figure this out. Recently in pork, the one thing that we were able to work on for you was in Argentina. We finally got that market cracked open, and I will tell you, it was not lost on us at USTR that we scratched one off the list of things to fix. That first one on the list in 1992. So we do have a pretty good memory and fight for these things for a long time. I guess the point I'm trying to make is when the issues that we have left in terms of market access in pork, but in agriculture in general, all the low-hanging fruit has been picked. These things now that we have to fix are very, very difficult. And for NPC's part, they provide us lists, PowerPoints, you know, I don't maybe tattoo on our arm of things that we have and a to-do list of things that we have to fix. And they're very, very, very difficult in large part to do it. But we're working on those every day. There are no silver bullets at this point to be able to do this. And this is going to get a little more difficult here in the short term. And I want to take a minute. This is actually part of the conversation I was having with the governor a minute ago. On almost on a daily basis, we're having this conversation with the agricultural executives in Washington, and I want to share it with you to kind of help you articulate what's going on here in the world of trade. There is or will be retaliation against U.S. agricultural exports because of what we're doing in other areas unrelated to agriculture. That retaliation is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood, depending on how you slice it and dice it, over $20 billion of our $140 billion in ag exports currently has, or is likely to have retaliatory tariffs against it. Let's be frank. The lead tip of the spear in all of this right now is your pork. You guys are probably being retaliated against in the pork industry more than any other commodity. And for my part, the first 232 retaliation was announced on March the 8th. My first day on the job was March the 9th. So from day one in the building, I've been trying to help my boss understand the importance of the fact that other countries understand the political power of U.S. agriculture. They understand if they want to get our attention where they go. And for my point in making the point with my boss, I say, look, that just means that when it comes to agriculture, we're at the front of the line to get our problems fixed first in these trade areas. And that's a message that I'm going to continue to discuss with my bosses, and they'll probably get a little grouchy with me, and that's okay. I'm going to just keep saying it because we've got to have these things dealt with and fixed. You know, these are numbers to you. I understand this, but I want to walk you through a little bit to help you understand. There's things called 232 and 301. Now, the 232 trade action is what we're doing against other countries in terms of their marketing operations for steel and aluminum. And interestingly enough, I had a conversation with a major buyer of aluminum in this country a couple of years ago. And I said, you know, I'm an old commodity, ag commodity analyst and expert. I said, I understand the ag commodities. Can you give me the 5-minute world supply and demand of aluminum? And he said, absolutely. He said, it's all about China. And one of their major facilities, they have a year's worth of aluminum just laying around the plant with no place to put it. And this was a couple years ago. And he said, you know what they're doing with that plant? They're doubling its capacity. They don't care if they take the price of aluminum to zero. It isn't about supply and demand to China. And I think that's to help you understand why we're doing this. We only have one facility left in the United States to make the metal, the aluminum that goes in our transformers. And everybody in rural America knows what a transformer is. So when you talk about 232 steel, aluminum, national security, that's what we're talking about. And those decisions are made by the President of the United States. And he means it. And he hopes to get countries' attention relative to that. And that even means Canada and Mexico, our two biggest trading partners. Now, there's another number here that I want to talk about. And that number is 301. And your homework assignment, even Governor, your homework assignment, I've had conversations with members of Congress. This is their homework assignment. On the USTR website, let me pull this out, there's a document. This is a 14-page executive summary I have here. It's a 200-page document. This is the findings of the investigation into China's acts, policies, and practices related to technology transfer, intellectual property, and innovation under Section 301. You have it. You printed the entire document. Governor, that document, it took them 8 months to put that together. 4,000 person hours to do this. This is a reaction to China 2025, which what we're saying here is in terms of unfair technology transfer, discriminatory licensing regimes, cyber theft of our intellectual property. We have tabulated that's cost our country somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 billion. And so very soon here, the president, this has all been put together over a period of months. Pretty soon the president is going to announce that we're going to impose those tariffs on a very specific type of Chinese high tech. Really, what we're so what's that mean in English, Greg? That means that China's 2025 plan, they've laid it out. They've told us exactly what they plan to do in terms of what they did in the solar industry, they're going to do in high tech. And what the president has said is, I'm not going to let them do that. I'm not going to let them destroy the Silicon Valley. I'm going to put up these tariffs to protect these high-tech industries in the United States. And he means it. And for their reaction, China has announced, well, we're going to counter to that some $16, $17 billion in retaliation ourselves. And that includes that's just in agriculture. And that includes about $12.4 billion in soybean exports to China, which they need for their own hog industry. So you see the game that's going on here. This is a tit for tat at the top of the world. But the president isn't doing, and we're going to talk about a couple of other things here that we, in agriculture, the problems that we have with China. But here's the point. What's the president trying to say? Their correct response to this is for these countries to work with the United States. Their correct response for even countries like Canada that, you know, sell a lot of steel to the United States is sit down with us and help us understand, you know, we're not going to let you continue to destroy industries that we have in this country. We've got to sit down and work this out. And for our part, you know, we're going to emphasize and continue to emphasize that we've got to have a dialogue with these countries in agriculture. Longer term, these are our customers. But we have some frustrations with China in agriculture as well, and I want to talk about this a little bit because this is important. We have two of the biggest WTO cases, I think, in history against China right now. One of them is with regard to their domestic subsidies, farm subsidies in China. You know, China hasn't told the WTO what their farm subsidies are since 2010. And in fact, we think by U.S. government analysis, USDA's analysis, that China has exceeded what it was allowed to do in terms of farm subsidies, somewhere in the neighborhood to the tune of $100 billion. That's 100 with a B, billion dollars. And you say, well, how help me understand the how this works. Let me give you some statistics. In the world today, the latest USDA report says that 38% of the world's residual supply of corn, 52% of the world's residual supply of wheat, 67% of the world's residual supply of rice, 22% for soybeans, and 40% of the world's residual supply of cotton is in one country. One country that's command and control. One country that doesn't work off the rules of supply and demand. China has that type of grain stocks today in its country. It's domestic. The price of wheat in China is double what it is in the United States, and they support their farmers to do that. We have got to convince China that it is not in our interest, it is in their interest to change the way it's doing business with regard to its farm support programs. Not only is it costing U.S. farmers money, how they're operating, it's costing every farmer in the world money. And what we're seeing in terms of corn in the last couple of years, we believe China has begun to change and drawing their corn stocks down. We're hopeful that we'll see them come in here with things like cotton, but we've got to have some pretty significant structural change in the way China is operating in agriculture. We also have a WTO case against them with regard to their tariff rate quota administration. In English, what that means is every country in the world, even the United States, has these. Is you're allowed to import so much at a low duty, and after you reach that amount of imports in a country, the duty kicks into a higher level. Well, China, when they became a member of the WTO in 2001, agreed to these TRQs and that they would import these amount of commodities in rice, wheat, cotton, corn. They've never done it. And so finally, our frustration was we filed a WTO case against them to say that we've got to fix this. We have their attention on both of these issues. So these challenges in trade are long festering. These China issues that I just discussed, I first found out about them when I was on the Senate Ag Committee in 2011. And we're still only about halfway through resolving them. That's the challenge and the difficulty. And I will tell you, you even see the tweets and the comments by the president today. He gets really frustrated by how long these things take. I can appreciate that. Nick, we've been doing it for a long time. These things take way too long. So what do we do about it? Well, for my part in this, and this is a conversation that I had when I was interviewing for this job, I said, in agriculture, we play offense. And the best thing that we can do here is while we've got all this stuff going on the defensive side of the ledger, we've got to go out and find new markets and play offense in other areas. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that today and maybe give you some talking points to help you articulate I'll take any advice and counsel you have on how we can do this. But we've got to get this NAFTA thing sorted out. And that's, from my boss's perspective, that's top of mind right now. We're still working out the auto side of this thing. I'm not sure where that is or where we're at, but NAFTA certainly is important to agriculture. It's critical to agriculture, and we've got to get that worked out. But we've got to find some new deals here. I am very concerned about the situation with Japan. And in terms of meat trade, that's our number one market, other than, you know, Mexico now with the pork, but in meat overall, it's number one. It's a huge market for us in agriculture. Always been one of our top three markets. But you have to understand, come next year, the Europeans have a deal with Japan. Canada and Australia have a deal with Japan. And all of a sudden, next year, these tariffs for those countries versus the United States are going to begin to go like this. And that's a problem. Interestingly enough, in our first conversation this morning, we were comparing notes. the commodity that may take it on the chin more than anybody in that relationship is wheat. So that's and those relationships go back decades. That goes back after World War II, the relationship between U.S. wheat farmers and the Japanese. So we've got to work on Japan. We're having conversations in Southeast Asia right now. My counterparts, Deputy Garish, just got back from Vietnam and the Philippines. So if you're keeping a tally at home, write those down. We're engaged in Africa, looking at different things there, and on down the road a piece here. We're also, I think, definitely going to have an opportunity to, I hope, to have a conversation with the UK, the United Kingdom, as they exit out of the European Union. That's a big market. That's not something insignificant for us in agriculture. There's no question about that. So we're looking at everything we can do. We're looking at memorandums of understanding. We just did one with Bahrain to work on things, talking to Saudi Arabia, talking to countries like Israel where we have deals and opportunities. We're even using things like the General Systems of Preferences Program, and Nick is smiling when I say that. We just announced that we're accepting a petition from the pork industry to evaluate Indonesia's preferences. What that is a program that if you're Indonesia and you have GSP, that means everything, just about everything you export to the U.S. is duty-free. And then you won't take our pork, Indonesia. Well, you know, maybe we ought to have a conversation about that duty-free access to the United States then, shall we? And that's our job at USTR, is to have very, very frank conversations with other countries. And I have to tell you, I really appreciate my boss. He's not shy. He is one tough guy when it comes to these kind of conversations. In fact, my first overseas trip here about a month or so ago was to Geneva to the WTO, where after years of working on it, we slid a piece of paper across the table to India. It was the very first ever counter notification of a country's what it's notified in terms of subsidies to the WTO. USDA spent over a year, a lot of man hours looking at what India was doing in terms of its subsidies. And they reported their subsidy on wheat was negative. Our analysis showed that on rice, they were exceeding what they committed to in the WTO, somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 8-fold. On wheat, 6 to 7 times more than what they were allowed to do. And so when we slid that piece of paper across the table, it was a pretty interesting reaction, let me tell you. There's no wonder with that kind of subsidy program, India has been the largest rice exporting country in the world the last few years. It's time, when you look at China and you look at India in terms of what they're doing in agriculture, that's 40% of the world's population. So if we're going to be successful, not only do we have to have market access, but we have to keep everybody playing by the rules as well. And I don't know if I said this or not, but I think I did. You know, China hasn't told us even what they were spending since 2010. Since 2010. So they want us to enter into these dialogues and discussions, but yet they want to operate by a different set of rules. We're going to provide a little more leadership in that area to have these conversations. In terms of animal agriculture, Undersecretary McKinney and I have conversations every day about the Codex and the OIE and the World Health Organization and IARC and all of these international bodies and helping people understand that there are international standards. There are ways and rules that you should follow, and we're trying to help and not punish countries, but help them understand and lead them to do that. And I think all of you can play a role in that here at events like this, where you can engage with folks around the world and help them understand. We have a very robust food safety system, regulatory system in this country. Quite frankly, it's the envy of the world. And we, you know, you can't just buy antibiotics for animals at Walmart and use whatever you want. Joy, you're laughing. I'll tell you, there's sometimes a perception that that's, you know, that's the way it works here, because oftentimes that can be the way it works in other countries, and they see our production system through the lens of their own. And so when they have, and even in Europe, you know, they have a problem that somebody violates the rules and there's fraud or whatever that occurs, their solution is, well, we're going to ban it all. And if we ban it all domestically, that means that if you're doing that in another country and you're trying to export it to our country, you can't do that either. So not only are we saying we're not going to use it in Europe, you can't use it and then send it to us either. Well, no, I'm sorry, but that's not how it works. These are international rules, guidelines. We have systems in place to do this and do this well. Now you understand the conversations that I have every day with other countries. We have a whole team of folks in government, and we interact with industry and folks like the U.S. Meat Export Federation. These are the conversations that we're having every day. And usually, Nick, I don't even have time for lunch. We're working on this as hard as we can. So I guess what I want to communicate to you today, you know, I'm one of you. I'm a son of a Kansas pork producer. I'm still very engaged and involved in the farm, and I can assure you when my time is up from doing this and we hand the baton off to the next person, my hope is to go back and spend a little more time on the farm here and continue to run back and forth from D.C. But what you can, in the meantime, what you can help us work on is continue to emphasize, in agriculture, we play offense on trade. We've got to continue to push to move forwards on these issues. We've got to begin to negotiate with other countries in getting new deals.